Good evening, everybody. Welcome to Moving Train Radio. It's Tuesday night. This is Jeff in New Jersey with my co-hosts Heidi and Dave in Minnesota. We had a couple of shows I thought were great. We did NASA last week, and we did Black History Month the week before. We're going to take a different turn and do something serious. Our topic tonight is missing persons and cold cases, and we picked out a couple of ones from that have been in the news, in my neck of the woods and in Heidi's neck of the woods. Some of them are cold cases, some of them are missing persons, and some of them are missing person cold cases. So I guess what the takeaway I'd like to get out of this is these things are things that happen in the news that you hear about, and then after a while it goes away, and then the 1 year anniversary comes up, and then it shows up on the news again, and then it's off the news, and then but there's actually really real people involved, and especially with missing persons where they don't know what happened to the person. That's something that they live with 24 hours a day, and I don't know, I can't imagine what it's like to have to get up in the morning and go to work and then come home and live your life. Knowing that somebody, your daughter, or your son, or your wife, or your husband has gone missing, or has been murdered, and nobody is able to even get a clue as to who did it. It's got to be a tough thing to have to live with. I'm gonna turn it over to Heidi first. We had highlighted five cases: three from Minnesota and two from New Jersey. So if we could start with the Minnesota ones. I'm going to turn it over to Heidi.
Thanks, Jeff. So the three cases that I picked out, I'm going to start with the most recent one that occurred. Let me see what the date is on this. It occurred in 2010, so April 25th or April 24th, 2010. So I'll try to set the scene for you. What occurred was there was a 911 call that came from a house in St. Paul. Female caller said, "Hey, there's somebody breaking into our house." Second call comes in. It's not the female caller from previously. It's now a male voice saying there's two people that have been shot. The police come. They find two people shot. One person, the female, is shot in the back a couple of times. The male is shot in the leg. The male, his injuries are not life-threatening. The female dies. So they were their husband and wife. Her name was Heidi Furkus. The husband tells the police this story. He tells them, the wife and I were up, laying in bed. We heard somebody break in through the front door, or downstairs we heard somebody break in. He grabbed his shotgun, told my wife to call 911, and I ran downstairs with my shotgun. The guy was breaking in through the front door, and he and I wrestled. I still had the gun in my hand, or he said that he still had the gun in his hand. He had the gun in his hand while he was wrestling with this guy. And during the wrestling with the intruder, his wife gets shot twice in the back. The intruder leaves. So a couple of interesting things about this. Number one, for me, that story sounds really hinky. The at the time frame that it happened, it was, you know, it's daylight savings time, so it's kind of, you know, 6-ish in the morning. And so it's still a little dark outside, but, you know, typically, and I guess, you know, I guess you could argue either way, people that are breaking into a house are probably not going to break into it at 6 o'clock in the morning on a Sunday morning, which is what this was. In the front door of the home, and knowing that there's probably people there, it just doesn't make it much, you know, that part doesn't make much sense. The second part that also doesn't make much sense with this case is that that day, the next day, Monday, their home was being foreclosed on. The wife, Heidi Ferkus, who was killed on Sunday, was unaware that the house was in foreclosure. So that is unusual. That would be an unusual thought that she didn't know. And so the reason that they say that she didn't know is because none of her family and friends knew, and they said that she would have obviously told them, hey, by the way, we're having these issues, and our house is getting foreclosed tomorrow. So they would have had to move out of the house. There wasn't any boxes. There wasn't any, you know, anybody moving. You know, you would see if somebody was moving out of the house.
Right.
So that's the premise of what happened. So he was questioned, but the questioning, obviously what I'm talking about is all circumstantial. There is no smoking gun per se. Yes, his gun was the one that shot her. And the intruder, of course, was described as a black male, 200 to 225 pounds, wearing a hoodie and a jacket of some sort. I mean, a vague description. There wasn't any sort of other description. And he escaped. He ran away. So again, there's a lot of parts of this case that make no sense. You're struggling with struggling at the front door with this intruder, and you have a gun in your hand, and neither you or then we have to wonder, he was also shot, but he was shot in the leg in a way that would be not life threatening. He didn't hit an artery. He didn't hit anything that would have, you know, really hurt him badly. It's kind of one of those things that, you know, if you want to stage a scene and you want yourself to get injured, you shoot yourself either in the forearm or in the lower leg. You don't hit an artery, you know, that type of thing. And that, of course, where he was hit in the leg was a place on the leg that you would hit yourself if you didn't want to, you know, do serious damage. Her getting shot in the back doesn't make much sense either, so there's been a lot of questions. He has not been arrested. He has not been charged. No one has been charged. And so it's one of those mysteries or one of those questions about where do you go from here? Was there an actual person that did actually come to their house that day? There doesn't seem to be a lot of evidence supporting that. But it is one of those cold cases that we have that's in the metro area that still, you know, they still come out with news stories once a year, usually once a year. I mean, it's only been almost five years now since this occurred. So they come out every once in a while and talk about it. He obviously doesn't live in the house anymore. He lives somewhere in the metro area somewhere. But it's unusual in that the story is kind of, does not make any sense. And the story is, almost unbelievable that she, you know, she didn't know that they were getting foreclosed on and, you know, all that stuff. So so that's the first case that I wanted to talk about.
Yeah, that does happen sometimes where if one spouse handles the bills without involving the other, sometimes happens where trouble occurs, and you know the spouse who's not handling the bills is taken by surprise.
Right.
Where's the husband now? Is he just like live somewhere else? Does he live in town, or did he skip town? Or?
He's still around, and by around I mean he still lives somewhere in the city. He is. You know, he's pretty much stopped talking to the police. So they questioned him that day and, you know, that night. And he's pretty much hasn't really talked to them after that.
And he just, lives a regular life. He goes to work every day.
Yeah.
And
right, yeah. So he hasn't been arrested. He was never charged. He was never arrested. You know, and I've talked to a few St. Paul PD officers about this that just in passing, and it's one of those things where, quote unquote, you know, just as in big quotations, they know he did it, they just can't prove he did it, which is, you know, there's a couple of those that we have around and with that kind of thing. One of the other cases that I was going to discuss too also, you know, has the same kind of element in it with the cops know it was him, but they can't prove it kind of idea. I was going to say, Jeff, we do have a caller. I believe it's probably Dave.
Okay.
Did you want me to grab him?
Sure,
I can do that.
Bring him in. But,
okay. All right. Hello, Dave.
I was
too
polite to push number one. They didn't ask me tonight, so I was just laying low. I wasn't here when you first started, but all I could think when you described the one that you've just been talking about was the Jeffrey McDonald at Fort Bragg 45 years ago, or however long it was.
That's funny you bring that up. I've read that book like a million times. It's a very interesting. I mean, I guess the difference is that with the Jeffrey McDonald case, he had the misfortune of having each of his family members having a different blood type, so their blood was easily tracked throughout the house. So, you know, this is obviously before the days of DNA, DNA testing. But, yeah, he was at least unlucky enough to have that distinction, so it was easy to follow the blood trail and know where blood was that shouldn't have been and where blood wasn't. So, but, yeah, it is, you know, there is some odd similarities, I guess you could say.
The strange thing was, with McDonald, I arrived at Fort Bragg for a tour of over 15-16 months, about 5 months after that, and there wasn't really any talk about it around. I mean, I don't remember it really ever being discussed while I was there. I guess it was already kind of yesterday's news, so it surfaced again. I mean, I was only kind of vaguely aware of it when I was right there. But
yeah, so for anybody that doesn't know what we're talking about, there was a 1969, Jeffrey McDonald, he was a Green Beret doctor at Fort Bragg, and his wife and two kids were murdered one night. He blamed it on Manson-style hippies, and very long story short, he was convicted of the murders and sentenced to life in prison. He is still in prison and maintains his innocence. There was a two-part miniseries of this particular book in the 80s with Carl Malden playing his father-in-law, Freddie Kassab. So, yeah, I've read the book a couple of times, as you can tell. But it's a fascinating case. So if anybody wants a good book to sit down and read, Fatal Vision by Joel McGinnis, very good book. But, yeah, so it's – Jeff, have you read that book?
No, I'm aware of the case, but I never read the book.
I think I read the news things and did watch the miniseries. I don't believe it. You know, I didn't read the actual book.
Yeah.
Now, did you
the
say,
book is,
Heidi, as long as – and I don't remember you saying it exactly, but in your blog, you know, in your summary that was online before the show, is this the one where the husband is – like not cooperating with the police or was not
right. So there's two cases that are in the same that I wanted to discuss tonight that are kind of on that same plane of wife is murdered, husband doesn't want to talk kind of idea. So both of them have the same element of the husband's kind of like, I'm not talking anymore. You know, he just doesn't want to talk.
And
he doesn't want to talk about it.
You can't try somebody, you know, without bringing evidence before a grand jury, but how do you just refuse to answer police questions? Is that within your rights? I mean,
you could say I refuse to answer. And in this case and in the other case that I'll talk about later, you know, the evidence isn't, you know, does the story sound hinky? Yes. Can you prove that he's lying? Now we were coming into gray area. I mean, you know, the thing about the wife not knowing that there was a foreclosure the next day, Jeff brings up a good point. Some couples, one person does all the finances and might not talk to the other person about the fact that there's some bad financial things going on. So there is that possibility that that's what happened in this case. And
isn't she dead?
Yeah, she's dead. Yeah.
And how do we know whether she knew about the foreclosure or not?
So what happened was that the following day was supposed to be the day that the house was being foreclosed on. She, according to her friends and her family, had never said anything about.
Oh, I got it. Okay.
About that there was a foreclosure, and it would have been something she probably would have said something about, like, you know, you need to help me pack. We need to write it. And there was no, there was nothing in the house that signaled they were packing to leave the house. So there was nothing, you know, there wasn't like they were in half stage of leaving or anything like that. What one of the speculations, and again, purely speculation, is that she found out he told her that evening and, you know, like when they woke up that morning or the night before, something, and they fought all night or, you know, something like that. And he ended up shooting her or, you know, I mean, that's a convoluted kind of, you know, with what they have for 911 phone calls and that kind of stuff. And then there's also a couple of people in the neighborhood that said that they saw somebody running down an alleyway. They heard voices, like angry voices in the neighborhood. You know, this is the St. Paul neighborhood that's much like my own here in Minneapolis. The houses are kind of close together. Sound kind of carries. I can hear, you know, I have the windows open because it's like 60 degrees right now. I can hear, if there are kids playing outside, I can hear a kid down the block, you know, a block away. I couldn't probably tell you where the kids are, but I could tell you that they're around somewhere that I can hear, you know, within hearing distance. You know, if they had their window open, somebody had their window open on that morning and heard somebody yelling, didn't necessarily mean it was these two people. It could have been somebody else. So that's, you know, that's testimony, if it ever went to court, that could be easily, you know, misconstrued or, you know, kind of thrown away, I guess. So, but that's where we are. It's been 5 years almost 5 years. There hasn't been any break in the case, and nothing's happened since he won't talk to the police. And, you know, he gave a statement and everything, but he pretty much lawyered up afterward. There's not much that they can do with him unless they charge him, and they don't have enough to charge him, and he knows that, I guess, at least. So, you know, there's not anywhere that they can go unless something breaks or they find out something, you know. And at this point, they haven't found out, you know, they haven't found a smoking gun, shall we say. So, but yeah, so that's where it is at this point, sadly.
Okay. What's next? Ann Dunlap and Barbara Dunlap?
So Ann Barbara Dunlap. Okay, so this is the other case that's very similar. So Ann Barbara Dunlap was an executive at Pillsbury. You know, the Pillsbury with the Doughboy at Pillsbury. And so she and her husband, Brad Dunlap, were building, at the time of her disappearance and subsequent finding of her body, they were living with her parents, and her parents lived around Lake of the Isles in Minneapolis. So for anybody that's not from Minneapolis, Lake of the Isles would be what you would consider the upscale part of the city. Big, huge mansions, beautiful lake that you out your front door. You know, the kind of place that has gardeners and butlers and housekeepers and, you know, that type of thing. So we're talking mansions. And so they lived around Lake of the Isles. They didn't live in one of the mansions, but they did live in that neighborhood, and that neighborhood itself is considered, you know, a pretty upscale neighborhood. So she and Brad lived with her parents while they were building a house in Medina. And Medina is one of our suburbs, which is also a pretty upscale place. Her husband, Brad, at the time, was working as a graphic designer. So his, you know, if you want to look at it this way, his level of, you know, money making was considerably less than hers. So her scale was much higher at Pillsbury. They had taken out, according to Brad and subsequently, they took out about $1 million worth of life insurance on each of them about a year prior to this incident. She had about $800,000 through her work. So on the day that she went missing, they were supposed to go out to dinner that night. She was going to go shopping at the Mall of America and then meet him for dinner. When she didn't arrive, he called the police, and so this is where it starts to get kind of weird, because when he calls the police, he doesn't sound concerned, and, you know, that's another thing that people can argue, well, what does that mean? Some people sound concerned, some people don't. But he calls the police and says, you know, what do I have to do to file a missing persons thing? My wife has been shopping 7 hours and I can't get in touch with her. And this is in 1996, so cell phones were not readily used or available at the time. You know, not everybody had one or that type of thing. And so the police told him he had to wait 48 hours to file a police report and to file a missing persons report because she was an adult. You know, he was really concerned, and they started, you know, it became public pretty quickly after this whole thing started because of who she was. You know, she was, you know, somebody that had a lot of, her family had a lot of pull. They were very successful. She was also very successful. And so they call, you know, so everybody knew. So the husband started these searches to try to find her, and he was very vocal, and he was on TV, and he was always there, and, you know, he just became, you know, he was just out there all the time. And so he did this searching on Lake Street and Nicollet. And on Lake Street and Nicollet, there's a big, giant behemoth of a Kmart. And so one of the things that was missing besides her was her car. So they didn't have her car. They didn't know what happened. They didn't know where she was. So they went into this parking lot, this big, giant parking lot, and he himself found her car in the parking lot of this Kmart in South Minneapolis, which is about, I would say, 2-3 miles away from where she was last seen, which was at her parents' house in around Lake of the Isles. Oh, and one part is she never... There was nobody at the Mall of America that ever, they could never say that she was ever there. There was no proof that she ever got to Mall of America.
Was there
so
any,
anyway, they find
there was no speculation that she killed herself rather than be found at Kmart?
Nope. So here's what happened. The car was found, and there was cameras there. So he was being followed by the press. The press was all over this story because, of, again, who she was. So he goes on camera. The car is still in the parking lot, and he gives an on-camera interview, and he's crying, and he's doing that Susan Smith crying where it looks like she's crying, but there's no tears, and he never looked in the camera, which made me go, that's kind of odd. So they take the car into impound. They pop the trunk, and there she is. She's been stabbed numerous times, and she's obviously deceased. So, like with the other case that I mentioned, they brought him in. They asked him all kinds of questions. Did you do this? Did you not? You know, what happened? Why didn't this happen? Why, you know, what happened? Why did you do this and why did you do that? And so he's in, you know, they're interrogating him because it's just, you know, the story doesn't hold up. You know, and it seemed very obvious. This Kmart parking lot is very obvious. It's in a predominantly African area.
Did he lead them to the... Did he find the car at Kmart before they did, before the police did?
Yes.
All right. Okay. Yes.
So he had a search party that was his friends, family, yada, yada, yada. He found the car in the parking lot. He did, not the police. And so this Kmart is in a predominantly black neighborhood. I used to live in this neighborhood, 2 blocks away from this neighborhood, so I know this neighborhood pretty well. The idea, it just, and when I saw where it was, you know, my first thought when I saw it was, okay, it just doesn't make any sense. And one of the other reasons it doesn't make sense is you know, this is Minneapolis. We have the Mississippi River, not too far away. If you were going to kill somebody and have their car, and you're trying to get rid of both of them, you dump them in the river. It wouldn't be that difficult to do. Leaving them in this Kmart parking lot, you know, with her in the trunk, seems a little odd. Seems like a strange place to leave a dead body because there's people in that parking lot all the time. There's things going on in that lot all the time. Police patrol that lot all the time because, you know, stolen cars are there. And so it seemed like an odd choice, and it didn't seem plausible to me anyway. So they interviewed him. He said nothing, and he clammed up pretty much. Clammed up completely. Now, the other thing that's kind of odd is her family stood by him and has continued to stand by him. They still visit him. He left Minnesota. He lives in Arizona. I think at one point, I think he changed his name, if I remember correctly, because of all the backlash, because of what we're talking about. He's never been charged either. He did get, from what I remember, he did receive the insurance money from her death. The only evidence they ever found was a blood drop in the garage that came back to her. That was all they ever found.
The garage of home?
Yeah, the garage of home.
The garage
home,
of their home?
Yeah, at their home.
Okay. Yeah.
So that was the only piece, and it was just like a droplet. It wasn't spatter. It wasn't, you know, a lot of blood. It was a droplet. And that was all they ever found. They didn't find anything else. And like I said, her family has stood by him. Her family has pretty much gone after the cops, said that they did a shoddy job. They thought that they were all in on it. You know, they treated them harshly. And I don't know how much of that I believe. You know, the police have a job to do. They have to find out who killed someone. They're going to ask the husband of the wife that's missing some hard questions. That's what they do. So I don't know. I mean, as far as that's concerned, but it is one of those cases where you just kind of go, that just doesn't seem right. Again, hasn't been solved. This happened in 1996, so we're talking 19 years ago now, and it's still unsolved. So, and like I said, so these are the two that are murders that we know we have a body and that type of thing that has still not been identified as far as the killer. It certainly seems like in both cases, the person who did it is possibly the husband. I mean, that's, you know, I could be wrong, but my feeling on both of them has always been that it was. But who am I? I'm a police officer, so. But yeah, so those are the Ann Barbara Dunlap one is pretty big, and the interesting thing about her is she was a runner. She was very athletic, and you know, that I guess that's one thing that doesn't work in the favor of the person of someone who says that it was the husband, because while he wasn't like out of shape or overweight or anything like that, really, he wasn't a big guy, and you know, it would be probably difficult for him to get her into the trunk of the car after he would have killed her, just because of the size issue and dead weight, and he, you know, his size. So, I mean, it could be almost, you know, a very difficult proposition unless he had help. But other than that, you know, who knows? But like I said, he left shortly after. He lives in Arizona now. He's remarried. He has two kids. So it's hard to know if that'll ever be solved.
Okay, and we have a true missing persons case on the case of Jake. I'm sorry. Jacob Wetterling.
Oh, Jacob. Oh, yeah, okay. So, Jacob, have you ever heard of the name Jacob Wetterling before?
I have not.
Okay. So, Jacob Wetterling is like the state of Minnesota's Adam Walsh, our Econ Pates. You know, any of those, you know, our poly class, that kind of thing. So what happened with Jacob is Jacob was 11 years old when he was kidnapped, and he lived in St. Joseph, Minnesota. So just I'm going to try to give you a visual about what I'm talking about. So he and his brother and his family lived on a farm in outside of St. Joseph, Minnesota. So Patty Wetterling, his mom and his dad, went to dinner that night at a friend's house. And the boys and his friend Trevor, his brother and his friend and Jacob wanted to go to the Tom Thumb to get a movie, to rent a movie. And they usually would ride their bikes there. It wasn't very far, but they lived in the country and they had to go into town to get the movie. And so they called Patty and her husband and asked, okay, if we go? And they said, sure, that's no problem. Just, you know, be careful, wash your cars, that whole thing. So they went to the Tom Thumb. They picked out whatever the movie was, and they were on their way back, and they were stopped by this guy. And he had a gun, and he forced them to get off their bikes. He brought them into the ditch, kind of, the culvert area, and had them go lay face down, and they asked all three of them their ages, One was 12, two were 11, and he picked up Jacob and took him with him and told the other two, you can't, you know, don't look at me, I'm leaving, you know, or I'll kill you, or whatever he said. He said something to that effect. And so he took Jacob and was gone. And this was in 1989, so it's been a very long time since this happened. So the FBI came out, the, you know, everybody that could, you know, try to find him were out. I mean, they were everywhere for forever. He has never been found. There hasn't been a lot of possibilities. You know, there's been some possible clues about what occurred. There was a farm very close to there where that night they asked the guy that owned the property, they, you know, went on to the farm, have you seen this kid? This is what happened. And he pretty much said no, and pretty much, I don't care, I'm going to sleep, which people thought was an odd thing to say, but there wasn't really any evidence there. They have, since 1989, they have served search warrants on a couple of properties around there. They've dug up parts of a couple of different people's property looking for him, and nothing has been found. And then, so since then, there's been some speculation and some rumors. There's a couple of weird, kind of odd conspiracy theories out there about it. There was some priests at a St. John's, where it's like a monastery where monks stay. There's been some issues with them with sexual abuse, and there's a missing guy from that area, Josh Dumont, who's been missing since 2002. And they are wondering if, you know, what's going on at that particular, that area, St. John's, has something to do with Jacob, because they won't let anybody go to this particular monastery and serve a search warrant. They won't let police inside at all, which is odd and strange, but really, I mean, it's one of those kind of conspiracy theories that, hey, everything will happen in the same area, maybe it's connected, you know. And so there's been a couple of pedophiles that they've interviewed that seem to possibly have something sinister that was going on in the area, but to get him, you know, either one of them to really go, you know, in Jacob's time frame doesn't really work necessarily. Probably one of the better leads is, there was around the time that Jacob went missing, there's a town called Painesville that's not too far away, probably what, like 10 miles away from the St. Joseph area, somewhere around there, that there were a couple of kids that were grabbed on the street, boys, and molested, and then just set free. The description of this particular person matches, or closely matches, the composite sketch of the person who took Jacob. Now, as a caveat to that, here's all what I'll say. It's a farming community. There's a lot of people that kind of look the same in farming communities. And I mean that, I'm not trying to be silly. What I mean by that is, you know, the composite is of an old white guy wearing a hat that you would wear in a farming community. You know, when I first saw the picture, you know, decades ago, I thought, hey, I know somebody that kind of looks like that. And I'm sure that a lot of people in Minnesota looked at that and went, hey, I know somebody that looks like that, because it kind of, everybody looks like that. You know, the face is kind of the same. So it's not a distinct look. So, you know, it can look like this person. It could look like that person. You throw glasses on him, he looks this way. So, you know, everything's kind of vague with it. He hasn't been found yet. There's been legislation passed about Jacob. It's called, like, Jacob's Law, to make, you know, to you know, find, make sure that pedophiles are, you know, more closely watched and so we know where they are and what they're doing and that type of thing. So it's, you know, so since that happened, Patty Wetterling, Jacob's mom, has run for office a couple of times. She hasn't won, unfortunately. She's a Democrat, but she hasn't won. She never was able to win. One year she went out. Didn't she go? Wasn't she? Isn't this? Yeah. Well, she ran. She ran for U.S. representative against Michelle Bachmann, if I remember correctly. Yeah, I'll have to look that up. I think it was Michelle Bachmann. So, I think that's where her district goes, all the way up there. So, but yeah, so that's the story of Jacob Wetterling. He still has not been found. It's, you know, they do serious updates every year here. I'm sure that pretty much almost all of central Minnesota has been searched for him. I mean, it's been so long, unless he's in somebody's house or he's entombed in something, I don't see that he's going to be found probably. I can't see that there'd be anything found at this point, except maybe a couple of bones here and there. But, you know, every once in a while there's a scare, like they find bones that they don't know whose they are, but it always ends up to be somebody else. But yeah, so that's probably the biggest one. If you are from Minnesota or you were around when he was missing, everybody kind of knows who he is and knows at least part of the situation and wonders about the case. And one of my friends grew up around that area, and it still affects some people even today. You know, your childhood became, you can't go outside now. You have to be with a parent at all times, and you can't ride your bike to the store anymore, and, you know, that type of thing. So there's a lot of, even residuals today from, you know, Jacob's kidnapping and his friend that was with him at that time and his brother still, you know, it still affects them today, obviously. So it's one of those things where everybody just kind of, it's the case that everybody knows if you're in Minnesota. Like I said, they talk about it a lot and, you know, on the news constantly. So he was abducted in October of 89. Yeah. Right. And so it was in October. And so his family can't, you know, whenever Halloween rolls around, it would have been the Halloween that they, you know, they haven't had a Halloween. It was like right, like a week or so afterwards. So it's, you know, like I said, it's something that they, that we see a lot of, we talk about a lot. So it's just one of those really sad cases that we don't know if it's ever going to be, you know, there's ever going to be a resolution, and there's no really great leads about it. And it's, you know, with child murders, it's just difficult because, child abductions, because there's so many possibilities. The family was pretty much, you know, they weren't even there. So they had, you know, an alibi. They were somewhere else eating dinner. There wasn't anybody that, you know, the family wasn't, you know, hated. There wasn't anything like that in their background. They didn't have any sort of financial issues. Jacob's dad's a dentist, still is a dentist. They still live in the same house. They walk by or drive by where he was kidnapped every day. So they stayed. So, but you know, you got to think it's just really sad and, you know, awful. Dave, Jeff, let me ask you this question. Is there one of these types of cases that is just, in your area of the country, that has been like decades and still no answer?
Well, there's two that jumped out at me. We moved, from close to Boston to the, quote, Metro West, Western suburbs, mm-hmm. in 1977. And very soon after we moved there, one town away, little blonde 11-year-old girl, was snatched off or disappeared from a pretty main street, like maybe a numbered highway, you know, two-lane
mm-hmm.
road, don't they? And Sarah Pryor, and everybody knew that name for, I'd say, 10 to 12 years when her remains were actually found very close to where she disappeared. But everything, you know, prior to that. And then the thing that I stupidly don't remember is if they ever charged any, if they ever figured out who did it, which I believe not, but I'm not positive. The other one, more recent, in the late 90s, I know, I think my son might have still, this girl was a year or so older than my son, and even though the thing happened about 50 miles away, they both happened to be lifeguards that summer. And a girl named Molly Bish was dropped off at like a state park at 8 o'clock in the morning. She was 17 maybe at the time. I don't think she drove herself there. She was dropped off for her day as a lifeguard. She may have even been like the one opening up and disappeared and has never been seen to this day. Every once in a while they come up with, you know, what would seem like a really obscure lead and somebody that might be involved due to very diligent police work that's gone on this whole time, but none of it's ever panned out to anything, and they've never found her remains or anything. She's a mystery. Molly Bish.
Wasn't this on a Dateline or one of those forensic files, or I swear that name rings a bell to me, so I have...
May have been. I don't remember it getting that national publicity. I just, you know, remember it because it was local. It may have, though. I'm not sure, yeah. But,
yeah, I swear that I remember this.
It would have happened.
Her last name is Bish or
Right
Fish?
Around 19... I'm guessing it happened between, like, 98 and 2001 at the latest in, you know, what's described as central... Central Massachusetts, not east or not way out west.
Yeah. Gotcha. Okay. Yeah. So I'm looking on the internet about, yeah. So the 16 years old.
What year was it?
On one of those shows, you know, and not the one where they tell you who did it, because obviously it doesn't sound like there was, but I swear that they, wasn't there some sort of guy in a car that they were looking at or some sort of craziness?
Yeah, but
somebody,
I mean, always very vague, though. I mean, nothing,
right.
You know, maybe I saw somebody or not a,
yeah.
Not a, we have to find this description, never like that, you know.
Right. Yeah, so the one article that I am reading about that I've just pulled up was, there was a possible suspect that, so it says last year, and that would have been, what year is this? So it would have been last year, meaning 2012, authorities searched the Florida trailer, of course it's Florida, of Rodney Stanger, who was a convicted killer who murdered his girlfriend, and they were looking for clues that might implicate him in the Bish case. He lived there in that vicinity when she went missing, and then suddenly moved to Summerfield, Florida, right after she went missing. But it doesn't. I don't know.
Yeah,
I didn't see this.
Would you say Rodney Stanger?
Yeah.
Yeah. I just pulled it up. This is Wikipedia. Yeah.
Yeah, and then yeah. So. Yeah, and then there's something, there's a video
His remains recovered June 9th, 2003. I don't...
Okay.
That doesn't ring right with me. That doesn't, hold on.
Because it says that they reportedly got a video that he had of a blonde girl stripping and having her neck snapped, but I don't know what that... And then they, I guess he really resembled sketches of someone that was hanging around the pond around that particular time. And so they were testing cigarette butts and duct tape. And so, yeah, they have a couple of different things that they were looking at him for, but it didn't find anything else.
That's crazy that I'm just reading. You know, I'm the one that brings it up, and I'm reading it now, that her remains were found 5 years later.
Sure.
Okay. Yeah. All right.
They tell you that the remains are found, and but they don't make it as, you know, it's not as big news as the other stuff is, the missing part. But, yeah, so, you know, with these kind of, you know, these kind of, I swear that I saw this. Now I have to find out where I saw this story at. But yeah, so she. But it looks like they haven't figured out who killed her at all. At least anyway, it doesn't sound like.
And here's this. Here's something 2014 possible new evidence. You know, possible
yeah.
new clue. You know, just last
yeah.
year.
Yeah, see, and then it looks like there's another suspect. Yeah, somebody named Gerald Battistoni. Yeah, so, who knows? I mean, and that's, you know, with Jacob Wetterling's thing, too, is there's been some pedophiles that have been in prison that have been, you know, that lived around there at the time, and so they were being, you know, they had been questioned and, you know, went on TV. And, you know, some of them, at least this one guy, he died now a couple months after his interview. You know, he was interviewed about the Jacob Wetterling thing, and he went on TV and talked about it. No, I didn't do anything, and my son didn't. And his son's also, like, a pedophile. and, you know, we didn't do anything. And then this guy, you know, this particular suspect died couple of months after this interview, but you know, there's a lot of speculation. The problem is, and for you know, the Jacob Wetterling case, and I don't know about this, it's the same for the Molly Bish thing too, is, you know, it was a small community that's not used to having a murder, is not used to having a missing kid, not used to having this kind of thing going on, and so they make mistakes. They don't question people right away, or they don't. They let evidence be taken away, and they don't set up a perimeter so they can, you know, look at everything that was there. They maybe, you know, drove over tire tracks that could have been, you know, photographed, and, you know, so there's a lot of things that happened that maybe if it was in, you know, like a city like Boston or a city like Minneapolis or, you know, New York or Chicago, maybe it wouldn't have happened because they would have known, okay, we got to treat this in a specific way, and we do this, this, and this to make sure that we, you know. So, you know, that's one of the things with this, and because of those mistakes and those issues at the beginning, some of the stuff is probably missed and can never be, you know, can never be looked at again because there's nothing, you know, you only get one chance for some of this stuff. But yeah, this is an interesting case, Dave. This is really interesting. I think I have to look more into this one.
Jeff, what was your, I guess the one that caught my interest was the people, South Jersey couple simply driving home from Philly.
Right.
They totally went up in smoke. What?
Yeah. Their names are, Richard Petrone and Danielle Embo. They were an on and off couple. They were in a South Philly bar about a year ago. I mean, about 10 years ago. And he was driving her home back to her home in New Jersey. And then no one ever heard from them since. Their cell phones, both their cell phones went dead the night they disappeared. No no trace of either one of them has ever been found, or the vehicle, which was a 2001 Dodge Dakota truck. It's kind of weird in that, you know, if they were murdered in the region, they would have been found. The guy was had some gambling problems, but
how bad a gambling problem?
I don't know. It just said that he had problems.
How soon did somebody know they were missing? Or were they a couple, or did they live together?
They were not living together. They were kind of a couple. You know, they saw each other. I'm rereading the news story. They called them an on again, off again couple. She was married but estranged from her husband. And he was divorced. So, there was no sign, you know, no sign of any murder. If the truck went off a bridge, the Delaware River is not that deep. They probably would have found it.
Did they have a number of days to quote-unquote get away, or did somebody figure them missing quite soon?
They did. Somebody was expecting them home because she had an infant at home.
So
somebody was babysitting, and she never made it home. So that's what tipped them. That's how they knew that she was missing. But what's strange is that the vehicle, a lot of times when, you know, if somebody gets whacked for, you know, for gambling debts, you know, they're not going to take the time to
torch the vehicle or whatever,
disappear the vehicle. So there's always a possibility that the two of them just decided to take off and start a new life. But with two kids, he had a teenager and she had an infant. That's unlikely. So it's a total mystery what happened to them. And every year, you know, this year happened to be the 10th anniversary, and they still don't know. They don't know any more than they did 10 years ago. There's no clue at all.
So nothing on their social security numbers. No credit. No movement. No job or anything on the nothing.
No clues at all.
So, and the vehicle hasn't been found at all.
Right.
Is there anyone else that's close to there that you could hide a truck? I mean, is there another river or a lake that you could throw it in?
I've driven past a place in South Philly 100 times and they crush 100 of them a day, right?
Yeah.
Is that still there, Jeff? Between the Walt Whitman and the airport?
Probably. But if like I said, if they somehow ended up in the Delaware, they would have been found, because the Delaware is not that deep. Something would have come to the surface. That's just and then this year being the 10-year anniversary, it was you know, in the news again, and the family members don't know any more than they did 10 years ago. But the most curious thing to me is that is that they didn't find his truck. Well, I have a personal story. This is about, I don't know, 10 years or so ago. My mom got an email from one of my cousins in Tennessee that her brother went missing. This is the son of a first cousin of mine who lived in, like, middle Tennessee. And he was supposed to be on his way to his father's house for a retirement party, and he never showed up. Now, he happened to be a sheriff. He happened to be a sheriff's deputy, which in a place like that is basically like a local cop, because towns don't have their own police forces.
Right.
So it was a pretty big thing in the news at the time in Nashville. Was it the nearest city? You know, there were, you know, helicopters, dogs, a massive search for him that went on for a week. And I thought, it's really odd that, and then, you know, because he was a law enforcement officer, you know, somebody may have had a thing, you know, for him. And, but I found it odd that they didn't find his car. And about a week later, my mother called me up and said, "Oh, guess what? Mike came home. He showed up at his parents' house, and he just walked in the door. It turned out he had just taken off, drove across the country, and then came back." So, I don't know what he's doing now. We're not that much in touch with that branch of the family. But,
wow.
That was but like, you know, my first clue that it was not foul play, they didn't find a car. If somebody had whacked them, they would have found the car, or at least found the car somewhere, like in a ditch or something.
Our Buster Sports Center. Buster, as you know, this is supposed to be the...
Sorry about that.
Yeah, that seems really, you know, I was going to say, Jeff, the car would be difficult to, I mean, unless, you know, I mean, if you lived in a desert, I'd say, well, you know, you can go out to the mountains, you know, and you know, if you lived in Arizona or New Mexico, hell, you could bring out a, you know, truck out somewhere in the mountains and just dump it off and somebody might not see it for years.
Yeah,
I mean, it's possible.
You know, airplanes go missing for, you know, a long time.
Now, Jeff, yours raises how minor a point. But I mean, if I disappear for 10 days and then walk back in the house, any governments or anybody that wasted money trying to find me, that's their hard luck, and it's not quote unquote my fault, right?
Well,
no, I mean, I'm half serious. I mean,
I really don't know what happened after that. It was kind of, we didn't hear much after that.
Yeah.
What
I mean, if you're holed up in some motel here, you know, somewhere watching TV and seeing all these, you know, people looking for you, I mean, you kind of bear some responsibility for it, I would say.
That's kind of a shitty thing to do. I mean, but there's a line. So if your person that goes missing has problems, so if it's somebody that's, you know, got problems with drugs and alcohol and they go missing for a couple of days, it's possible they just went on a bender, right? I mean, that would be what your thought process would be if somebody that has a, you know, really good job, has a happy family life, doesn't have any sort of mental illness, goes missing. That's a different, you know, people kind of look at that differently and go, oh, okay, what happened? You know, because that's not normal behavior.
Right.
You know, there's levels of, do I worry or do I not? You know, it's like with the woman in your story, the one with the infant at home, you know, if she didn't have kids at home and she and her boyfriend just decided, you know, or you know, left this bar and went home, or said that they were going to go home, and then they decided to take a road trip to, I don't know, Edmonton, Alberta or something, and didn't tell anybody, you know, that would be different. But the fact that he's got kids and she's got an infant at home, that would, you know, tend to point that maybe that something they were taken or they left not on their own free will.
Yeah.
But I was going to say,
and there's no clue,
you know,
that's what happened to him. We have another case here, and this is recent. This is new. Case of Erica Crosby or Erica Crippen Crosby. She was out with her husband at a restaurant in Cherry Hill, New Jersey. They lived in Mount Laurel, where I happen to work, and both she and her husband went missing, and then a couple of days later, the police saw. His husband was driving his wife's car, and the police, he did something to make them pull over, and then they saw it was him, and they searched the car, and they found all that they said, and this is back in the middle of January. That was really the last news story that came out on this. Was that they found enough forensic evidence in the trunk to charge him with murder, although there was no body. So he's locked up, and the family is trying to get answers as to where she is. But what's really curious about this is that there's been no... no word from law enforcement, no word in the press. I mean, if you Google the story, the last thing you'll see is, I think over the weekend, it was her birthday, so there was, a vigil. But before that, the last story you're going to see is something from, like, mid-January of when he was arrested. Now,
I'll hang up in a second.
There's been massive Twitter campaigns as a hashtag, bring Erica home. If you go on Twitter and go to the hashtag, bring Erica home, there's people every single day going after anybody in the news. This story's got, you know, Nancy Grace written all over it. The husband was a... He was an ex-con. He was a drug addict. He had a girlfriend on the side. He sold his wife's clothes and some of
what?
His stuff to buy drugs. This is a story that, you know, the Nancy Graces and Dan Abrams of the world would be all over, and it's really odd that they're not. I never once, when I do this thing here, I have HLN on with no sound, and there's always a new missing, at least one missing person. Usually it's a white teenage girl, whenever they're not talking about Whitney Houston's daughter. But this is a case that I don't know. I don't understand why the tabloid. I could see why, you know, law enforcement might be keeping them on because they're trying to get it out of the husband. You know, where's the body? And but I don't see why. I mean, this story is tailor made for tabloid shows like Nancy Grace and Dr. Drew and Jane Velez Mitchell and Dan Abrams and Court. I don't think they have Court TV anymore, but
no,
it's tailor made for that. And so there's no, it's just no news. So the family is, you know, they hand out, they show up at, you know, neighborhood at shopping centers and hand out flyers, and you know, they've done searches, and I reached out to Team Erica, who's got a Facebook page, and said we were doing this and invited them to call, but I guess they didn't want to call in. But it's really disturbing to me, you know, number one, because it happens so close, to an area where I'm very familiar with. Last place they were seen is a, you know, place where I go from time to time for lunch.
Where was that, Jeff? I'm curious if it's Perry Hill.
PJ Wheelahan's. It's a small.
That's not Cherry Hill. That's right in Haddonfield. There's one right in Haddonfield, isn't there?
Yeah, there's about a half a dozen of them.
Yeah, there's one right on Haddon Avenue, but no, that's not the one you're talking about.
Yeah, there's one on Haddon Avenue. This is the one on Cherry Hill on Route 70.
Oh, okay. Jeff, one thing. I got to ring off, guys. This was, it was good stuff. But I'm, you know, as much as it's easy to, like, criticize the tabloids, do you think sometimes, you know, law enforcement does, you know, tell them wait a while on this one and they actually, you know, comply?
That could
be. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it sounds like maybe, you know, the tabloids could just screw up the case against the husband.
Right.
Yeah.
I mean, I was reading when we were talking about it, Jeff, that they were... I'm sorry. You can go.
Yeah, it's never held them back before.
All right.
Put it that way. Yeah. If you remember, you know, Scott Peterson and.
Yeah, that's true.
I think there was another guy. I don't know if his name was Scott Peterson or something that sounded like Scott Peterson.
No,
three wives. Who,
right. Yeah.
Three wives.
I gotta go. Catch you next week.
All right.
Thanks again.
Bye, Dave.
But, you know, that's never stopped Nancy Grace before from making a spectacle out of this.
Right.
So,
you know, I was going to say,
we never see it on the news. So nobody, mm-hmm. you know, I follow it on Facebook. I go on Twitter, you know. About every other day, I hashtag bring Erica home. I see what's on there, and I retweet.
Right.
But there's really the family at this point. You know, they just want the body.
Oh God! But it sounds like I read the one of the articles that you had posted about it, and it sounds like they think that it's possible that he used certain devices to destroy maybe the body or something. They were mentioning a possible, as awful as it sounds, a wood chipper and it doesn't explain why they think that. So and they said that the evidence that was found in the trunk was evidence that there was, you know, that someone had died there or that there was enough probable cause to arrest him. So I would want to, if there was a lot of blood evidence back there or some, you know, body tissue or something that would warrant that arrest. They're not
talking. They're very close-mouthed about it, and I don't know why, you know, usually in a case like this, you know, the accused might, you know, use the location of the body as a bargaining chip to escape the death. But
right.
We technically have the death penalty on the books here, but nobody's been executed in the state in decades. So, you know, even if he ended up on death row, you can't really use the death penalty as a bargaining chip. So, like, why he's not saying anything? I don't know. We'll have to wait and see when it goes to trial if anything more comes out that would lead them to the to where the body's buried.
It's really a sad. I mean, it sounds like, you know, what was leading up to it. He wasn't exactly the greatest guy in the world either. You know,
yeah.
A lot of times you hear, oh, well, he must have just snapped because he was such a good guy. But it sounds like in the case that you're discussing that maybe that wasn't the norm. That wasn't the, you know, for at least for that guy, it doesn't sound like he was a great guy before. And it sounds like it's unfortunate that here this woman is that seems to be a really great person and got mixed up with someone so, you know, horrendous and so awful that's what happened. In all of these cases, you know, even the ones that I had been talking about and the one that David discussed, you know, there's some, some really interesting cases out there. It would be nice to get them maybe from other states, too. I was going to say we have another caller, so hold on a second. Oh, 703. Hold on a second. Caller, you're on the air.
Hi, it's Kathy from Virginia.
Hello.
Hi, Kathy.
Hi, guys. I've been listening to the show tonight, and definitely I've been wondering, too, about Erica, and especially that the Nancy Grace ignoring the story. I'm not a fan of Nancy Grace. I'll just say that right from the start. I never liked her. I always felt like she was a ghoul. She was, you know, not an ambulance chaser, but if there's some kind of equivalent in the work that she does to an ambulance chaser. But you know what I was thinking about? Why are the police not telling the public anything? And the only thing I can think of, over and above everything else that you all have talked about, is maybe this guy, the husband, maybe he was some kind of informer. Is he like a confidential informant or something like that? And is there something going on? You know, is he, you know, maybe over the years, if he's a drug dealer or whatever, he was working with the FBI or, you know, or the state police or something, and they're trying not to tell too much or something like that about what's going on because it's going to compromise other informants or something. I'm just trying to find some kind of logic, and I'm having trouble doing that. But, you know, could that possibly be have something to do with it? Because this is really, this case is, I mean, the quiet that's coming out of the law enforcement agencies is just, I've never experienced anything like that recently.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, that's the possibility, Kathy. You know, we can only speculate. Or they, this is Mount Laurel, New Jersey, which is, you know, a quiet bedroom community outside of Philadelphia, and, you know, murders just don't happen that often around here.
Right.
And, you know, the police, might not be equipped. I don't know if they're bringing in extra resources from the county or the state but any kind of search parties have been organized privately, you know, by the family, promoted on social media done by through the church or through the friends and the family. We don't see much so maybe they do know something, and they're not saying, like, you don't see any footage of of cops with dogs walking around, you know, through the woods around here, searching for a body. So maybe they just know something and they're not saying for, you know, whatever reason.
Yeah, I mean, just the fact that husband was arrested, I mean, that's huge. You know.
Yeah, he was arrested right on the spot. Like,
right.
He was arrested. He wasn't just arrested for, you know, obstruction or whatever. He was arrested for murder. So there was definitely evidence, and they're not saying what evidence they have, but they just said that they have evidence that a murder was committed. So he's been charged with murder, and he's locked up, and you know, he's not talking. So, and again, I'm saying, like, you know, the talk. I think Nancy Grace should be disbarred if she still has a lawyer's license, because I don't know how anybody could get a fair trial if she's covering, you know, a trial, you know, squawking about somebody's guilt, you know, for hours and hours and hours. But, you know, the tawdriness of this particular story is really, you know, to me, like I said, tailor-made for her, you know, to demonize the husband. You know, she was the mother of I think a 7-year-old and an infant. So this is a Nancy Grace story, if there ever was one. So why she's not covering it, I don't know. It's just very strange.
That's sad.
Yeah, I'm trying to figure out, you know, I mean, if he was arrested for murder, let's say on the strength of what they found in the truck, you know, that means that there is enough blood or whatever that, you know, a person who bled that much couldn't have survived. Okay, so, you know, then, I don't know, you know, I don't understand. And, of course, you know, I know that there's the Facebook page that you all had mentioned, you know, for Erica, and the Twitter every day. And, you know, I don't want to say racism, you know, but it's when you go down the list of the cases that Nancy Grace jumps on, you know, right off the bat, you know, go down the list, this one definitely meets all her criteria except for one. And
right,
that
right.
is not white, you know, and,
right.
and, you know, I just don't get it, you know, so I'm trying to be thoughtful and say, okay, you know, I don't want to say, you know, that this is because she's African-American, the victim is African-American. You know, I try
right.
not to say, but it's a glaring, that's a glaring, you know, it to me, I don't know. You know, there has to be something that, you know, I have some familiarity with New Jersey, but a long time ago, you know, 30 years ago. And I know I knew Mount Laurel back then, and I know what a, you know, a nice community it is and everything. So there, that meets Nancy Grace's criteria, you know, that, you know, she's renowned for saying, oh, things like that don't happen here. You know
right.
that's just one of
yeah.
the taglines, you know, and so, you know, I really don't understand. I mean, it doesn't matter how much demanding, you know, people like me or people like you do on social media or whatever, it's not working in this case. So I'm trying to say that maybe this guy who's arrested, his husband, you know, maybe he knows things that, you know, whatever knowledge he has, maybe as a confidential informant or whatever, they're trying to protect the other people. I don't know. I'm going to hang up and listen to the rest of the
That's an interesting theory. He's an ex-con. He had just recently got out of prison, on drug charges, and he was working as I think an apprentice, either a pipe fitter or a boilermaker.
My only thought with the Nancy Grace thing and why she didn't she hasn't talked about this particular case. My only thought when I was listening to you guys talk about it and you know, kind of looking over what the case is possibly there's two things. One, it seemed to be almost, you know, a very short period of time between her going missing and him getting arrested. And his arrest was because of what was found in the trunk that they're not really talking about. So my guess then would be that it was enough, as I said before, that there was probably, my guess would be there's blood or some sort of human remains back there that were, you know, enough for them to charge him for something like that. And so because there's no element of who done it or any element of, you know, there's no trial coming up. So it's not like with,
Casey Anthony.
Right, when it was a constant, right, it was a constant every day, yeah, with the tot mom,
yes.
And I'm sorry, but I wanted to shoot myself if I heard tot mom one more time, and I didn't even listen to Nancy Grace, but I swear I heard tot mom on everything that, you know, if I turned it to CNN, she was there, and it was constantly
right.
Casey Anthony, and so, you know, and you know, we could go on and on about the Casey Anthony case, but maybe possibly, you know, from death or at least disappearance to arrest, no trial. Maybe those issues play into why she doesn't talk about this particular case. And I'm playing devil's advocate a little bit only to look on that other side. I kind of agree that maybe it's the color of her skin, and that's why nobody's really talking about it. Can I say that was 100%? No, but it wouldn't be surprising. You know, the ones that I mentioned, the three that I mentioned in Minnesota, there's at least three or four others that I could mention, too, that are people of mixed heritage that are missing, but we don't know anything about them. Missing or their murders are unsolved, but there's literally no information. Like, I would be telling you their name, they're missing from here, and then that's it, because there was never much reporting done. So any information I would get would be nothing. It would be, you know, it would be like reading the news, and I'm just reading a story. There's nothing really there. And so that's sad. And now we could have a whole show about that particular issue, but I was going to say we have a minute and 50 seconds left, Jeff. It's been a really great show again.
For the future, I could try to get a hold of the Team Erica through Facebook and maybe get a family member to call in.
Okay, that wouldn't be such a bad idea. I like that idea.
Visibility.
Okay,
I don't have anything else. Anything else? To add,
okay.
So that was a good, interesting hour and a half.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, it was a great show. You know, of course, we didn't solve any mysteries, but you know, if anybody has any others that they would like to talk about or discuss, just let us know on our Facebook page on Moving Train Radio, and anything like that, we would absolutely do. So it looks like we only have a minute left. So I'm done, Jeff.
Yep.
Anything
to add? Off and, we'll see you next Tuesday on St. Patty's Day.
Great.
Or we take St. Patty's Day off.
It's
I'll
up to you. I mean, I'm not
on Sunday.
Irish. I might have some beer. That'll be my thing. But, yeah, it's up to you. No corned beef and cabbage. But... All right, so next Tuesday then?
Yep.
Perfect. Okay, good night, everybody.
Good night.